ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit LeggMason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Connor will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Welcome to ETF Prime, Nate Geraci alongside Connor Kelly. As always, thank you so much for joining us. I also want to thank the exclusive sponsor of ETF Prime, Legg Mason. So last week, the investment world lost a true legend. Vanguard founder Jack Bogle passed away at the age of 89. And look, I think whether you're an advocate of passive investing, active management, maybe you fall somewhere in between, whether you're a longer-term investor, a day trader, I think just about everyone agrees nobody did more for everyday investors than Jack did. He really made it his life's mission to help educate and, quite frankly, help make sure investors weren't getting ripped off by Wall Street. And with that as sort of a backdrop, he, of course, somewhat inadvertently built one of the largest fund companies in the world in Vanguard. Connor, today you and I are going to try and pay tribute to Jack Bogle. To me, I think one of his single biggest gifts was just his ability to deliver very powerful messages in a way any investor could understand, right? So typically Wall Street likes to make things complicated, use jargon, buzzwords, academic lingo, because if investors don't understand something, maybe they'll pay more for it. But Jack always kept things simple. He wasn't afraid to focus on the basics, which I appreciated because I don't think there's enough of that in investing. Just placing a focus on things like saving money, keeping investment costs low, diversification, taking a longer term approach to investing. To me, his magic was really in his simplicity.
You know, he spoke in plain English because his focus and who he cared for was the average investor. And he spoke their language on purpose, Nate. Like you said, a lot of people in finance make things intentionally more complicated than necessary. And Jack Bogle did the exact opposite and tried to make things as simple as possible so that any investor, regardless of their investment experience or knowledge, could understand the points that he was making. And, you know, you used the term legend earlier, and that is not hyperbole about a man like Jack Bogle. I mean, it's easy for us to forget how difficult it was for him to launch Vanguard back in 1975. And, of course, launching the first index fund. The fund did so poorly at first, it was actually dubbed Bogle's Folly. I mean, the firm only had around $11 million in the index fund a year later, 1976, which was, I think, about 10% of what they had internally as a goal of like $150 million. And you mentioned this earlier. He ruffled some feathers on Wall Street when he launched Vanguard to try to keep people from getting ripped off, right? Talking directly to the average investor. And it was an uphill climb for many years, which I think is, it's easy to forget all of these early struggles when we look at the Vanguard today, right, that's managing, you know, just short of $5 trillion, it was a real challenge for him to even get this firm to survive for the first, you know, several years.
Well, I actually think that's reflective of another one of Jack's defining characteristics, which was just his grit and determination. You know, he believed strongly in what he was doing, and he simply wasn't going to be dissuaded. So look, you and I will spend some time discussing Jack's legacy and some of the things that made the biggest impression on both of us. We're also going to hear from ETF.com's Dave Nodig on what Jack Bogle meant to him. Dave actually had an opportunity to meet Jack in person a few years back, so I'm looking forward to that conversation. Dave will join us in about 20 minutes. And then to close the show today, we'll switch gears. We'll be joined by Connor O'Brien, CEO of O'Shares ETF Investments. O'Shares was founded by Kevin O'Leary, who most probably know as Mr. Wonderful from ABC Shark Tank. So Kevin wanted to invest his family's own money, and he created one of the ETFs we'll spotlight today. It's a rules-based strategy focused on quality, low vol, dividends. And I think it tells you something that Kevin chose the ETF wrapper to put this strategy in. So we'll visit with Connor about the founding of O'Shares and look through their lineup of ETFs. Again, that'll be in the back half of the show. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com, or you can find us on Twitter at Nate Geraci and at CKelly1980. All right, so I want to start today with a couple of my favorite sound bites from Jack Bogle. These are both from The Retirement Gamble, which aired on PBS several years ago. We covered this on the show back at the time. This was about how people are basically getting ripped off in their 401ks. And to me, these really encapsulate Jack's message. Take a listen.
Costs are a crucial part of the equation. It doesn't take a genius to know that the bigger the profit of the management company, the smaller the profit that investors get. The money managers always want more, and that's natural enough in most businesses, but it's not right for this business.
And then he goes on to say this.
What happens in the fund business is the magic of compound returns is overwhelmed by the tyranny of compounding costs. It's a mathematical fact. There's no getting around it. The fact that we don't look at it, too bad for us.
So look, those are two pretty simple, short clips, but to me, they say everything about Jack Bogle. He wanted to shine a light on investment costs. And I think Jack Bogle's legacy will be that he did force a lot of investors to really consider the cost of investing and question what they were getting in return for what they were paying. That's why, you know, I know he's referred to as the father of indexing, but I see him more as the father of low-cost investing.
Yep.
Because remember, about a quarter of Vanguard's assets are in actively managed strategies. And even Bogle himself made some pretty active decisions, right? He was famously against investing in international stocks, for example. You know, there are some other examples out there. So I know he's always going to be tied to indexing, which makes sense. But I think the spotlight he put on investment costs was a game changer.
You know, Jack had quite a few famous quotes, but one that really sticks out is he always said, in investing, you get what you don't pay for. And like you said, Nate, Vanguard isn't an index-only company. They've got some very large, extremely successful, actively managed mutual funds and ETFs. For Bogle, it was all about the simple math, and that clip mentioned that. If the market return is what it is, any investment cost simply detracts from that. So the higher the fee is, the higher the hurdle is for that fund to return market performance, whether active or passive. That was the crux of his approach to investing, is minimize the fees paid by investors. And, you know, the other thing interesting about these clips is it always seemed like Bogle was talking about costs or diversification or investing for the long term. You know, instead of pitching products, it always seemed like he was there to educate investors rather than sell them. And I think that really resonated with people over the years, was his approach was much more about educating the average investor as opposed to trying to sell them on his particular company.
Well, I mentioned at the top that he somewhat inadvertently built Vanguard into what it's become today. You know, to your point, he wasn't really out to sell. It was like Vanguard was this manifestation of his core beliefs, and he was just very convicted around those beliefs, especially as it relates to investment costs. Let me play another clip here. He was on Bloomberg's ETF IQ a little over a year ago. Listen to what he says about Vanguard.
You know, I was never in this business to build a colossus, but as I told people many times, I was too stupid to realize that if we gave investors the best deal they would ever get, I'd be building a colossus. And so here we are.
You know, I just love that because you can hear there, he was just a humble guy. And if you think about what Vanguard has become, I mean, how many other people could have built what he did and not have a huge ego? Certainly not many. But, you know, I think the other important piece here as it relates to Vanguard was Jack's ability to do something very difficult in the investment space, which was he was able to put low cost and high quality in the same sentence. Because there's this thought, which is still, I think, a big problem today, that the more you pay for an investment, the more you get in return, right? Mm-hmm. The higher the quality. We've talked about this before. Do you want cheap wine or a cheap car or cheap running shoes? That mentality gets extended to investing where people think cheap investments are somehow inferior. Jack Bogle made a lot of progress in changing that mindset.
You know, Nate, there were so many great tributes written him over the weekend. And a point that really stuck out to me was that, you know, he was pretty proud of not being a billionaire. You know, the Johnson family, which founded Fidelity, there were billions and billions of dollars. While, you know, Bogle had an estimated net worth last I saw of $80 million. And while that is undoubtedly an enormous amount of money, that was nothing close to what he possibly could have earned as the founder of what is now a $5 trillion investment management company. And the reason behind that is how he established Vanguard, because its structure is truly unique in the world of finance. Vanguard is a mutually owned company, meaning the company is owned by the funds. And since investors own the funds, the firm is essentially owned by the investors. And what this means is the firm is almost like a nonprofit, because any profits that are above and beyond the expenses running the firm are essentially plowed back into the funds to reduce the expense ratios of the funds. And that structure is what has allowed Vanguard to provide incredibly low fees to their investors, you know, as opposed to enriching Bogle and all the other fund managers, which is pretty much how the rest of the finance world has always operated.
Yeah, I don't think we can pay tribute to Jack Bogle without talking about the way he structured Vanguard.
Yep.
Because that was clearly a game changer, and it's still extremely disruptive today. I actually want to ask Dave Nodig about this here in a moment. You know, Vanguard's structure is such a competitive advantage. I just wonder if anyone can overcome it, how this will end up playing out longer term. But look, we need to take a break. Hopefully we were able to do at least a little justice to Jack's legacy today. He certainly had a large impact on how I view investing. Connor, I know it's the same for you. I want to leave you with this. So Warren Buffett, obviously one of the most admired investors of our time, along with Jack Bogle, and I'm guessing history will forever link these two together. But he had this to say at the 2017 Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meeting, and like Jack, the beauty here is in the simplicity.
Jack Bogle has probably done more for the American investor than any man in the country. Jack, could you stand up? There he is. Jack Bogle.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our tribute to Jack Bogle. We'll be joined by ETF.com's Dave Nodig. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate and Connor in studio. Let's chat with ETF.com's Dave Nodig.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s.
For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets.
The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
Dave, obviously we're paying tribute to Jack Bogle on today's show, and you wrote a really nice piece last week, I thought appropriately titled Saint Jack, by the way, But you talked about how much Jack meant to your own career. I thought we could maybe start there. When did you first come across Jack Bogle's work, and what was it that resonated with you?
I think like most folks, I discovered indexing and quant finance and Jack Bogle and Ben Graham all at the same time, right? Just as I was learning about investing, maybe in the 80s, really, honestly. And I didn't get a chance to meet the man until well into my career, maybe in the late 90s, and really didn't have many interactions with him. But I think it's safe to say he really acted as sort of a stake in the ground on one way of doing business that I think was inspiring to a lot of us.
What was that opportunity like, having a chance to meet him in person? That's something that I've never had an opportunity to do. We'll certainly always regret that. But what was that experience like?
Well, I think one of the great things about Bogle was that he was actually remarkably available. He would talk to college students who would call him up on, doing research papers. One of the things you'll see if you just Google him is that he shows up everywhere. He shows up in school newspapers. He shows up on CNBC. He shows up in the pages of the Wall Street Journal. He really was willing to talk to anybody about the things he was passionate about. And that was always just that individual investor. And, my personal experiences with him were pretty minimal. I wrote about in my article sort of one, sort of long interaction I had with him in a green room ahead of an event. And he was just the most humble, natural, easy to speak to guy you'd ever meet. I mean, in some ways, he was like the parish priest of investment management.
Well, to your point, just looking at Twitter last week, I was absolutely amazed at how many people had pictures with Jack or personal anecdotes of meeting him. And Connor and I were actually talking about this a little bit earlier, but do you think that's one of the reasons his message resonated so well? Just that people saw him as an everyday person and so they could relate? Perhaps they didn't feel like they were being sold something?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was never anybody less of a salesman than Jack Bogle. And in fact, towards the end of his career, the last 10 years, he actually sort of made it his job to be a thorn in the side of those of us in the industry, and I'll put myself in the same box, that we're selling things, that we're out there trying to invent better mousetraps or sort of further the evolution. He really believed, I think, until his dying days, that the better mousetrap had been found and the problems had been solved. And he would quite often go off on, the same kinds of things we talk about, the proliferation of new ETF strategies, about ETFs being things that engendered trading, about the problems of too much money following the same strategies. He did not go quietly into that good night, that's for sure.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, because it's pretty well documented. Jack had, I think we'll say, a complicated relationship with ETFs. Some may even say a love-hate, probably more hate. And I think to your point, he certainly appreciated broad index ETFs, but he didn't like the fact that ETFs could be traded intraday. He had heartburn over all of the different ways markets are being sliced and diced with ETFs. Of course, Vanguard famously didn't offer ETFs until after Bogle left the company.
Yeah.
So what was your overall impression of his views on ETFs?
Well, I mean, that one big interaction I had with him and the work that he did speaking at our Journal of Indexes editorial events, he very much felt that the packaging mattered, right? That the core idea of low-cost indexing was great, but that it could be used for ill, that it was, as it were, a sharp tool. And he was just not bashful about putting that out there. I mean, he really tried to get people to focus not on the theoretical returns of products, but on how people actually use them, how actual investors use products. And the research he was doing right up till the very end was about how the actual holders of products experience their own personal returns. And so by that case, if you look at the average holding period of ETFs, it's not a lifetime. It's much shorter than that, because there are so many people who use ETFs as trading vehicles, even while many of us use them as real long-term buy and hold vehicles.
Well, I actually came across a quote in the Wall Street Journal. This was from several years back, where Jack said ETFs were like a shotgun, great for hunting, but also excellent for suicide. I mean, Jack always had
correct.
A certain way with words.
Yeah.
Do you think Jack saw ETFs as sort of his Frankenstein? He launched the first index mutual fund, which was obviously the predecessor to ETFs. Do you think that turned into a monster in his eyes?
Yeah, I think so. I think that that was part of the reason he spent so much of the last 15 years really trying to educate people about the double-edged sword nature of easy access to things, whether that was simply the easy access to the tools of indexing to make long, short, buy and hold strategies that he always lambasted. Simply that by giving people so many choices, we forgot some of the Ben Graham-ness, right? I mean, he was always fond of talking about Ben Graham's core strategy of you really only need two things. You just need access to bonds, you need access to equities, and you should be weighting those between 25 and 75, and you're done. And that simplicity, I think, has a real appeal. And the honest truth is, I think, as we would all agree, the vast majority of investors would, in fact, be better off doing less.
I know you're extremely well-schooled in ETF history, and Jack actually turned down an opportunity to partner on the first ETF, SPY, with Nate Most. And some view that is a pretty big mistake at the time. Of course, Vanguard has, I think, recovered pretty well. But do you have any insight into sort of the internal wrestling at Vanguard, even after Jack left, around their decision to launch ETFs, just given how large of a shadow Jack had cast?
Yeah, I mean, I think Vanguard has wrestled with its unique structure over and over again, right? I mean, the its mutual nature, where it's owned by its shareholders, is obviously wonderful for doing things like maintaining costs and sort of keeping a certain ethical set of guideposts, right? You never have to worry about what the right thing to do is, because you just ask what you would do as a shareholder. So there is a certain cleanliness to that, but it makes innovation really challenging because, you know, at some point somebody says, hey, I have a crazy new idea and I need $100 million to go chase it. It's tough to do that if your only guidepost is what's the best thing for my existing shareholder. And I think the launch of ETFs was largely about that, right? Who is going to get an advantage if I was just a Vanguard mutual fund holder for launching this whole new ETF business, right? And I think now we can look back on it and say, actually, there have been some fantastic advantages even for those existing Vanguard mutual fund shareholders in terms of growing the asset base, lowering expenses, and managing taxes. So there have been big advantages, but I think they were hard to see at the time.
Well, and it's interesting to your point, even today, Vanguard is still very meticulous with new ETF launches, right? They're certainly not throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks. So as we look forward here, as I'm sure you saw, Jack wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal towards the end of last year where he expressed concern that indexing had maybe grown too much. And I think he was most concerned that if a few large fund companies control nearly every U.S. company, that might cause some issues as it relates to corporate governance. Do you view that as a concern?
I think it is actually one of the big stories that will, frankly, probably dominate the rest of my career. Right? The next 10 or 15 years, I think we're going to be talking a lot about this. I think the math behind sort of low-cost, large-scale passive indexing is inexorable. And so we're going to only see more of what we've seen, which is more and more concentration and a handful of players. It's also true that economies of scale in this type of business are extremely important. So it's unlikely we're just going to magically have 25 new indexes, 25 new index competitors that somehow usurp the dominance of both the traditional index providers, the S&Ps, the MSCIs, the FTSE Russells, or those firms that are leaning on those indexes, the BlackRocks, Vanguard, State Streets of the world. So this is going to be a real issue we discuss. Now, I happen to think that there are real ways to solve this, that we can use technology to, for lack of a better term, pull the intents of the investor base of these large firms and actually bring people back into corporate governance. I think it's a bit of a myth to think that, you know, active mutual fund shareholders are somehow paying a lot of attention to how their fund managers are voting proxies now either. So I actually think that we have a lot of really interesting ways to engage investors in governance in new and interesting ways, and to look through the shield of the index mutual fund or the index ETF to get at those things. So I think it's a solvable problem, but it is one I think we're going to hear a lot more about.
Well, I think one other solution that's been proposed, I think Jack mentioned this in his op-ed, and it's easier said than done, but it's simply more competition, right? Don't just let Vanguard and BlackRock and State Street run roughshod. And I know Jack has actually mentioned that he thinks other companies may need to adopt Vanguard's mutual ownership structure to compete because it's such a competitive advantage. I guess, one, do you agree with that? And then two, why hasn't anyone tried to go that route? Why let Vanguard monopolize the mutual structure?
Well, I mean, the mutual structure isn't a completely brand new idea. It's only new in the asset management context, right? I mean, we have regional banks and savings and loans and credit unions and insurance companies have all taken their tilt at this particular windmill. The problem is it's not a particularly efficient strategy for innovation or for capital allocation. It's a great structure for running an ongoing business. And so, you know, you pointed out that Vanguard tends to be very slow to do new things. Part of that is because of this. And so when we talk about people coming out and competing, it's extremely unlikely to me that that's going to come from any kind of a mutual structure because it doesn't reward that kind of risk-taking. Capitalism tends to reward that kind of risk-taking. So while I agree more competition would, if it existed, help ameliorate some of those concerns, I don't see that actually happening. I actually see the opposite happening. I see more concentration at the top. I think we'll have lots of smaller competitors, but when it comes down to corporate governance, I don't think we're going to compete our way out of having a handful of large asset managers who kind of roll up the governance votes for a lot of corporate America.
Dave, it's Connor. So we've discussed this on the show previously, but what happens to innovation if there are only four big firms, you know, 10 years from now? You know, that there was, it seemed like the start of the ETF world, the large players focused on the plain vanilla, you know, broad indexing and let the smaller players do what they wanted to in the niche space, right? And then, you know, last couple of years, you get a firm like Robo, you know, that launches a fantastically successful robotics and automation ETF. And all of a sudden, a year later, or a couple years later, I guess, iShares launches their version of that, right? iRobot, IRBO. And all of a sudden, you're seeing the largest players start getting into these niche segments where the smaller innovator players could actually have some success. And my real concern is what happens down the road if there are only a handful of dominant players, because like you mentioned, at these low margins, right, of handful of basis points, scale is probably the most important aspect of the game in town.
Yeah, I think the counter argument I'd make to that is, yes, we see, you know, let's pick on BlackRock here for a minute. BlackRock has definitely got, you know, the biggest game in town, yet they're the ones out there, you know, looking at layoffs, right? Because their business has become so big and so multifaceted that even with their dominance in passive and with ETFs, they've sort of gotten too big for their britches and other parts of their businesses had to pull back. And so I think there is a bit of a double-edged sword there. Companies that become very big end up having other kinds of problems, and smaller companies are generally able to be more nimble, to launch new products, to open up new spaces. We saw this with the robo-advisor space too, right? I mean, we saw Wealthfront and Betterment really open up a market, and yeah, then we saw Schwab and Vanguard come in with their approaches that garnered a lot of assets, but it hasn't put Betterment out of business. They're still doing great too.
Dave, do you see any realistic scenario over the next, I don't know, 15, 20 years where somebody becomes a real threat to Vanguard and BlackRock?
You know, we've talked a little bit about it before, but I think the distribution is actually much more important than product design at this point. I don't think anybody's going to innovate their way to the top of the leaderboard with a better version of, you know, a large cap equity index. But I do think players with big established brands, whether they're financial services brands or whether they're internet-based brands, Google, Amazon, folks like that, that have a lot of customer touch and a lot of customer loyalty, I think they could be very disruptive in the investment management and, frankly, in the broad financial services space. So I think the importance of brand and distribution is going to be paramount over the next 10 or 15 years. And that's why I think we're going to see some really interesting moves there. And, you know, I'm not sure whether Jack Bogle would approve of those actions, but I think that's the way we're headed.
All right, so I want to ask you two quick closing questions here on Jack Bogle. First, is there anyone you can think of who's out there right now that can maybe take the torch from Jack and sort of be the everyday investor's advocate?
You know, I had a feeling you were going to ask me that question. I've been racking my brains about it all weekend long, and the honest truth is no. And I think that we're in, some of this is the internet, I think we're in a bit of a post-legend world when it comes to financial services, right? I mean, I don't look around and see a lot of Peter Lynch's and Warren Buffett's and Jack Bogle's as rising stars. Obviously, we have, you know, a handful of portfolio managers that we you know, sort of know and revere and hang on their every word, whether it's, you know, folks like Gundlach or things like that. But in terms of the sort of tireless, selfless advocacy that we've seen out of somebody like Jack Bogle, I think he's a once-in-a-generation kind of guy.
Do you think that's a problem, or do you think Jack's message is out there so well now, it's so ubiquitous, that it's not a problem, that people know what to focus on?
Well, no, it's always a problem, right? I mean, education is never done, right? I mean, as a fellow media person, I'm sure you get that sense of, like, haven't we talked about this before? And then you go look, and yeah, it was 2 years ago. Well, guess what? 2 years ago is a long time, and every day there are new investors coming to the market. They need to hear these messages over and over again. So I don't think the work is ever done. And so with that context, the loss of Jack Bogle is just a straight-up loss.
All right. And then if you had to boil down Jack Bogle's legacy into just a few words, what would you say?
He said it himself so many better ways. My paraphrase would simply be, keep it simple, stupid. Mm-hmm. The things that I took out of Jack's speeches and his books were almost universally boiled down to, don't overthink and overcomplicate what is a pretty straightforward discussion. There are a lot of nuances. There's a lot of ways to go wrong. But fundamentally, coming back down to that idea of do the simple things really well, do it cheap, and don't overcomplicate your life, that was the message I took from him in my one longer interaction with him was, you know, be a little boring, be a little forgetful. And I think that's a pretty solid message.
Well, Dave, really appreciate you sharing your thoughts on Jack Bogle today. No doubt the investment world has lost a true legend. I don't think any question, nearly every investor is better off because of his efforts. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, guys.
That was ETF.com's Dave Nottig. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll close the show today by spotlighting the O'Shares lineup of ETFs. We'll be joined by the CEO of O'Shares ETF Investments, Connor O'Brien. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate and Connor in studio. We're now pleased to be joined by Connor O'Brien, CEO of O'Shares ETF Investments. O'Shares currently offers four ETFs. Those ETFs have about $600 million invested in them, led by the O'Shares FTSE U.S. Quality Dividend ETF, ticker symbol OUSA. And interestingly, the company was founded by Kevin O'Leary, who is probably best known as Mr. Wonderful on ABC's Shark Tank. Kevin is the chairman of O'Shares. Connor himself has over 25 years of experience in the global investment markets. He was previously at Lehman Brothers in Merrill Lynch. He's been involved in private equity. And we're now pleased to have him joining us via phone from Montreal. Connor, great having you on the program today.
Good morning. Great to be on the call.
Connor, first, I'd just love to hear more about the background of O'Shares, how the company was started, and perhaps how you first met Kevin O'Leary.
Yeah, sure. Kevin and I have been working together for over 10 years, had a mutual fund company, and we basically evolved the business model into ETFs, mostly because ETFs are so much more cost-effective and tax-efficient and transparent, basically healthier for investors. And that's where the money wanted to go. The money flows into ETFs are huge, and the money flows for mutual funds are actually out. They're negative. So money is basically leaving mutual funds to go to ETFs, and, of course, we want it to be where the investment vehicle was most investor-friendly and attracting money.
All right, so let's walk through your flagship ETF, the O'Shares FTSE U.S. Quality Dividend ETF, ticker symbol OUSA. Take us through how the holdings are selected and what the end investment goal is here.
Sure. The ETF OUSA is essentially a quality dividend ETF. And people might say, well, I know what dividends are. What's quality? The first thing about dividends, really important for people to think about, is it's, of course, income. And the dividend strategies have a 20-year history of outperforming value growth and the S&P 500. So we've got good income and you've got great long-term performance, and you actually have all of that with less risk. The quality aspect is unique in that what we're measuring here is for stocks of companies that have very profitable businesses and very strong balance sheets. And that helps you avoid stocks that have a high dividend but a business problem. You don't want to own those stocks. You want to own those that have good quality business with a strong dividend culture, strong dividend growth as well. And one final thing about dividends, if you look at dividends on large cap stocks, they have a history of essentially doubling over every 6 or 7 years. So that's great. You invest in dividend stocks and your income grows, essentially historically showing doubling every 7 years or so.
So what is the starting investment universe for this ETF, and then how many holdings do you end up with?
Yeah, we start off with all of the U.S. large cap stocks, over 500 of them, and we have in a portfolio now just about 140 stocks. So it shows you is three quarters of the stocks don't qualify. They fail on some test of balance sheet or profitability or dividends or volatility. And you stay away from those stocks, and what you see from the history of performance of OUSA is great performance, comparable to or slightly better than the S&P 500, and quite a lot less risk. Even on a day like today, markets are down, OUSA is down quite a bit less. So it's that shock absorber that you get, or the downside protection that you get from owning those high-quality stocks.
Now, are there any caps on sector exposure or even on individual constituents?
Yeah, there are caps on the individual stock position sizes, as max of 5%. And then on the sector allocation, there's a limit on how much different than the regular index the portfolio is allowed to be. So that controls for a really good diversification across all sectors, all stocks.
And when you talk about the factors here, quality, low vol, and dividend, as I'm sure you're aware, there are a lot of different ways you can skin a cat and determine what to hold. If you look at something like quality, how are you determining that?
Yeah, so there are several measures. The measure of profitability is return on assets, and that's proven to be, through research, very, very effective at selecting good quality businesses because you're getting high level of profit on the dollars invested in assets. The second very important metric is leverage. And the most interesting way to measure leverage is your ratio of cash flow to debt. Not something else to debt, but your actual cash flow to debt. People that have mortgages know that their cash flow is what pays the debt. And with companies, it's the same thing. So those are very important metrics.
Now, in terms of portfolio application here, you were previously discussing sort of the risk profile of OUSA compared to the S&P 500. Do you see this ETF as replacement for that large cap exposure, a core holding in a portfolio?
It's a great complement. It's a great replacement. Depends on the investor objectives. If they really want to reduce their risk and have stronger long-term income, OUSA is a terrific component, maybe the biggest component of their large cap allocation. And then we do the same thing for small cap. Maybe you're going to go there next, but OUSM is the ticker for small cap. And historically, people have had small allocations to small cap because they think it's risky. If you actually eliminate the non-profitable companies and focus on highly profitable small cap businesses and stocks, you end up with OUSM, which has just over 200 stocks instead of 2,000 small caps, has just over 200 selected for high profitability, strong balance sheets, the same process. And the measure that actually surprised me when we first looked at it is the profit level of the generic small cap index compared to OUSM. The generic small cap index has a return on assets that averages just above zero. In other words, the average of all the small cap stocks, the 2,000 biggest ones, is almost zero, whereas the profitability of OUSM is about 9% return on assets. So those are great, profitable businesses. The average size of them is a little bigger than the generic index, and it gives people a very much more comfortable way to have an investment allocation in small cap stocks. And it's timely right now. Small caps are less exposed to trade wars, and everyone knows trade wars are basically one of the biggest issues that's keeping markets down right now.
And Connor, you guys also offer a European stock version of the strategy. Is that correct?
Yeah, so talk about a market that's been oversold, is underowned, and of course has the whole Brexit cloud hanging over it, probably very, very priced in, to use that expression. So OEUR is the ticker for our Europe ETF, and it owns large global multinational companies that are selling their products in the U.S., of course, Europe, and the rest of the world. They just happen to be headquartered in Europe, listed in the European exchange. The average P.E. now of those stocks is around 11 times. Super, super cheap. About the cheapest in 5 years. And I think it's all because of this Brexit overhang that's now, of course, very priced in. There will be some solution of some sort. You don't know what it is, but something will change. The uncertainty will pass. And a category that's oversold and underowned will probably experience nice positive mean reversion. That's an expectation. It's not a guarantee. But we think that Europe is very oversold, fantastic companies, global players, and they just happen to be in Europe, and they happen to be cheap in OEUR.
Our guest is Connor O'Brien, CEO of O'Shares ETF Investments. We're spotlighting the O'Shares ETF lineup. Connor, more broadly speaking, you know, there are a lot of factor-based ETFs on the market, and it seems like more are launched every single week. I'm curious, how do you attempt to stand out or differentiate in such a crowded marketplace? Do you feel like there's a lot of noise out there?
Well, there are a lot of choices out there, let's put it that way. And for people that are trying to figure out all of them, it's a lot of work. In our case, you know, we've had our funds reviewed by all of the major firms, and we're reviewed and approved and on the platforms of all the major firms. People who are doing their work individually can look at the data. They can look at our website, oshares.com, to get information. And I think probably the most useful thing to do for people who want to do their own work, take a look at the portfolio, see what's actually in it. Yes, look at the performance as well. Look at the risk. Look at what's happened in down periods or down days. See if it's a risk level that fits your appetite. Look at the performance over the long term. See how that works for your appetite. And really look at what is in the portfolio. So OUSA, OUSM, these are stocks that selected the way we talked about. And, there's lots and lots of choice out there. And I think people just need to fine-tune a little bit how much they have time to look at and then see if they like what they see in the portfolio. And if we have one more minute, what I'd tell you about is e-commerce, where we do have an e-commerce-focused ETF, ticker OGIG, and it owns not just U.S. e-commerce and Internet companies, but global e-commerce and Internet companies, basically designed to own the giant e-commerce and Internet companies across the world, regardless of geography. And we've taken a quality approach to that as well. In other words, avoiding the stocks that have balance sheet problems. And it's a terrific way to be exposed or invested in a category with growth that is more than double the growth of the NASDAQ stocks. We think that's a terrific way for people to put some of their allocation into the growth categories. And, of course, that's a category that's been somewhat oversold, again, due to this U.S.-China trade war situation.
Yeah, and again, that ETF is the O'Shares Global Internet Giants ETF, which was launched last summer. I'm curious, what was the rationale behind launching that ETF?
Well, there's no other way to actually, in one ETF, own all of the world's fast-growing global Internet giants. And it's difficult for a lot of investors to access stocks that are listed outside the U.S. A little bit over half of the stocks in this ETF are outside the U.S., and it's unique in that respect. The other is this ETF has stocks selected in part based on the quality of the balance sheet, as I mentioned, and the other part is based on the strength of their revenue growth. We did the research. We determined that revenue growth is a very, very important contributor to the long-term performance of e-commerce and Internet stocks. And as a result, we adjusted the portfolio weightings to reflect higher weighting to stronger growth companies.
Any thoughts on valuations in this space? Of course, last year in the U.S., the FANG stocks were making a lot of headlines, right? There were concerns over valuations. Perhaps there still are. Any thoughts on the valuations?
Yeah, the valuations are the lowest multiples they've been at in about 12 months. And the valuations are cheaper outside the U.S. than in the U.S. The growth rates are higher outside the U.S. So you basically get more growth at lower valuation multiples outside the U.S. than in the U.S. People make this popular comparison now, FANGs versus BATs. BAT being Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent, the three biggest, best-known names in China and Asia markets. They're actually cheaper than U.S. stocks or comparables, and their growth rate is about 1.5 times higher. So I think it's all, the whole space is pretty cheap. The Internet's here to stay. E-commerce is here to stay. It's going to keep on growing at phenomenal rates. there's higher growth rates outside the U.S. I think people should own both. And OGIG is a way to own both.
Connor, we have about a minute left here. I'm just curious. I know you can't talk about specific filings or what exactly you may have in the hopper, but are there areas in the ETF industry where maybe you see some white space and perhaps you're looking at launching some new product?
Yeah, sure. I can tell you a bit about that. So our positioning really is built on a cornerstone of quality, so that we have quality measures that drive an important portion of stock selection in each of the ETFs that we bring out. And we've done a lot of work on quality value, quality growth. We have filed prospectuses that are available. People can look at those. And so that's an interesting category. And it's a way of basically avoiding stocks that fail on measures of profitability, fail on measures of strong balance sheets, but still have good metrics for value, good metrics for growth. So quality is our zip code. And those are examples of funds that are filed. Another area that we are looking at very closely where we think quality also really matters is in corporate bonds and, generally speaking, the fixed income market. There's so many indexes out there that are somewhat generic. They just own everything. And they end up owning more corporate bonds of companies that have the heaviest debt load. Now, that doesn't make great sense, does it? You want to not necessarily invest more of your fixed income, safe, low-risk money in the companies with the heaviest debt loads. You probably want very careful diversification across the companies that have good quality balance sheets. So that's an area where we're doing quite a lot of work. So that's the zip code, quality, and we do think there's a lot of white space. We think investors will make their choices based on the characteristics of the ETFs that are out there. And we definitely aim to be in the marketplace serving investors that like this kind of approach.
Well, Connor, I think that's a perfect place to leave it there. A pleasure having you on the program today. Certainly appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
That was Connor O'Brien, CEO of O'Shares ETF Investments. And you can learn more about their ETF lineup by visiting oshares.com. Connor, I don't know if you remember, but when we were at Inside ETFs, I think that was, 2 years ago, Kevin O'Leary delivered one of the keynote addresses and talked about their lineup. And you know, what's interesting about O'Shares, I think they have a really good investment process under the hood. Obviously, you have to do your homework, make sure it's right for you as an individual investor. But having somebody like Kevin who can speak to the lineup, obviously people know him from Shark Tank and kind of know the way he approaches his deal making. So that's something that I think they have working for them, at least getting exposure out in the marketplace and perhaps resonating with end investors.
Oh, I think it's a huge advantage. You know, the average investor doesn't know one fund manager or fund company from another, but they sure as heck know who Mr. Wonderful is. And, you know, it goes beyond that. You know, their core funds have done a pretty good job gathering assets. And I would actually be very interested in seeing what they do potentially do in the corporate bond world, because I do think that's a very that's a space that is ripe for some new competition coming in with better ideas.
Well, I'm not comparing Kevin O'Leary to Jack Bogle, but obviously Jack Bogle and his presence helped Vanguard in the marketplace. So certainly having a personality doesn't hurt. That'll do it for ETF Prime. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. You can visit leggmason.com to learn more about their broad range of investment strategies. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at etfprime.com, etf.com, iTunes, and Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter at Nate Geraci and at CKelly1980. Next week, we're going to preview the world's largest ETF conference, Inside ETFs. We'll be joined by John Swolfs, CEO at Inside ETFs. And then Bill DeRoche, Chief Investment Officer at FFCM, is going to spotlight one of the best performing ETFs of 2018, the AGF IQ U.S. Market Neutral Anti-Beta ETF. Until then, have a great week, everyone.